Hey guys, today we have the pleasure of Paul Carlton joining us. Paul is a infrastructure engineer at Stripe.
Correct.
At this point in your career.
Mm-hmm.
You've held roles at Google for several years. You left to join a startup in Oakland called Judicata in the legal.
It's in San Francisco.
Oh, location.
Yeah.
And then most recently, you left Judicata to join Stripe.
Correct.
In San Francisco as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I know you went through your job seeking round most recently and discovered a ton of tools that you used. And most recently, you got exposed to what are people actually asking in the job market these days for different roles.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is further back, but I think people are very curious about what is Google asking these days. What's the hiring bar for getting a job at Google these days?
Yeah. I did an internship at Google when I was still in college, and then converted to full time. So I did sort of like the phone screen for the interview, and then had to do some interviews at the end of my internship. And actually, funny story about that was they told me during the interview or the internship, they said, you have to, you're going to get two interviews and they're going to be strictly the technical questions, the kind of thing that you would see like in Cracking the Coding Interview, basically, like the Gail Lachman book. They said they were going to be specifically those questions those type of questions. Because there's also, sometimes you get like design questions or sometimes behavioral, but mostly just design or the coding ones. Mm-hmm. And my first one was like that, it was like a linked list, some sort of like linked list question. Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
And then the second one, the interviewer said to me, why don't you just tell me about your internship project? And I was like, oh, sure. Yeah. And so like, I like drew it out on the whiteboard and like told them all about it. And then, a couple weeks later, like after my internship was over and I was like waiting to hear back from them, they said, oh, like, only one of those interviews counted because the guy asked the wrong question. So I had to fly out to, because I was like, I went back to school and like started school, and they had to fly me out to Seattle to like do another interview. And I actually chose Seattle because I wanted to interview at Microsoft and Amazon too.
Oh my God.
So I did. I ended up having a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Back to back to back.
Yeah, like Microsoft, Amazon, Google interviews. It was just like a kind of funny situation.
One of the things I know about you that's kind of, I don't know if it's unique, but you've interviewed three times, it sounds like four times at Google between your internship, interviewing for the full-time role, I guess three times. And then most recently when you left Judicata, you considered going back to Google and they put you through the same hiring process that any other experienced hire would go through. So what was the most recent experience like, and how long ago was that again?
So that was in March. So, and the way it happened for Google was, once I left Google, they had a person called like their alumni coordinator, who was in contact and said, if you are interested in coming back, reach out to me. And so I did reach out to him. And they were, when I was, deciding to look for my next role, and they said, okay, if you want to come back, you have a couple of different options where, like, depending on whether you want to come back sort of at the same level of responsibility, if you think that you've kind of progressed in your career, then maybe you can interview. And I was like, sure, I want to interview more. like, why wouldn't I try to go for a higher, higher level of responsibility? So I ended up interviewing again in the San Francisco office, and it was kind of a funny experience because when people looked at my resume, usually in the Google interview, you come down, you sit down in a conference room, and they have your resume and they talk about that a little bit, and then they get right into like a technical question, and it would always, they'd kind of look at it and be like, why? You've already worked here. Like, they kind of ask, like, why are you thinking about coming back? And, why are we interviewing you again?
Yeah.
Cause it was just kind of like a strange, we know that you've already passed this bar. So why are we like having you go over the bar again?
Were they worried that you already knew the questions they'd be asking you? Or?
They didn't say that, but, I know like one of, it was some, one of the like, design questions was like one of the ones that is like, how to I remember it being like the how to ask a design question was like that. What that was it's the one
pretty
was the
example.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
So that was kind of funny, but yeah, they're all really nice about it. And
so it sounds like the questions that they asked you the first time around were the same questions or similar in nature with the whiteboarding and the design system design type of questions as the second time around that you went through their hiring process or whatever.
Yeah, definitely Google is very much like on the whiteboard. And the second time around, they were more focused on design questions. So I think I got like two design questions and one coding algorithmic one.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other time, I think I was all algorithmic.
So I know when we've previously chatted, you had a wealth of advice and resources that you used in the most recent job search. Do you mind sharing, like, besides going and doing interviews and getting the practice of having interviews under the belt, do you mind sharing how you prepared for the most recent job interviews you did?
Yeah, definitely. So I was fortunate. So I decided early to sort of save up and take time off in between jobs rather than try to interview while still holding a job.
That can be rough.
Yeah, it's just kind of, you know, you're trying to explain why you're gone for a day or a couple hours for phone screen. Anyway, I decided to just to take some time off. So I had a lot of time on my hands, and I fortunately, after talking to this to the like the Google alumni person, knew that I kind of had a way. You know, I felt pretty comfortable that, you know, worst comes to worst, if nothing else comes up, then I can like Google, there is a way for me to go back to Google,
which you ultimately decided not to do. Which we'll hear that story later.
Yeah, sorry. I'll
try. No. But so you were mentioning how you had a lot of free time and you came upon a lot of extremely valuable resources for preparing for this round of interviews.
Yeah, definitely. So I had started, my in previous rounds, I'd always gone back to cracking the coding interview, which I feel like is like the interviewing Bible. So I had set up a bunch of time and I said, okay, I'm going to spend, I wanted to spend like 20 hours doing questions before I like do my first interview. Cause I said, if I had the time, then there's no reason for me to not do that before I go to this first interview.
Yeah.
Cause otherwise, why, you know, what am I to not put my best foot forward?
Yeah.
And so I had started doing that, and I think I saw it on either on Hacker News or something. I remember this site called Interviewing.io, which is a site that will, you sign up for it and they'll pair you with somebody who has interviewing experience at a company that does this kind of typical tech whiteboarding sort of interview. And they'll pair you, and it's anonymous. And then you can, they'll basically run through a question with you. And then right at the end, they'll give you feedback like immediately on like while you're still on the phone with them. And then also they'll give you written feedback after that.
So is this over the phone or is it webcam or is it screen share?
Yeah, it's all on your laptop. I think you can dial in with your phone, but it was, it's like a coder pad, I think, is
sure,
they kind of integrate through
an
that.
An interface where it's real-time text.
Yeah, real-time
like
text.
Like Google Docs. Or...
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah, and I think you can execute code and kind of dependent on what the question was like.
Sure, sure.
That.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I signed up for that, and actually they were in private beta, so they were not, or I don't know, so anyway, they had like a waiting list, and so I didn't get on it. And they actually recommended me to go to called Interviewing Cake, which is this site, which I had mentioned it's sort of like a self-guided interviewing practice tool where it gives you a bunch of questions and it'll kind of start you off. And if you've done technical questions, you know, there's a lot of kind of layers to them a lot of times where there's like the first, you know, there's a couple of key insights you need on each of these questions. And then you kind of get as far as you do. They're kind of sometimes sort of layered. So that way, you know, if someone, there's always further to go and you aren't just like, halfway through the interview, like, oh, I guess we're good.
I mean, this is common to a lot of technical interviews is have more problems in case the candidate gets through a lot of it very quickly. So.
Exactly. And so this tool, Interviewing Cake, is a tool that basically does that in a web page where they'll give you the question and then they'll say, you know, you'll type in your answer here, and then it'll kind of give you nudges of like, have you checked for this thing? Have you checked for this thing? Almost like someone would do in an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I've I thought it was crafted very well in a way that mimicked like the actual interview experience of the nudges that you would get. And like the nudges where you see the question and you're like, oh, I haven't, oh shoot. Like there's like a whole area of this problem I hadn't really thought about and mm-hmm. I should look at that.
Well, you were mentioning interviewing.io mm-hmm. and interview cake.
Yeah.
And the thing that you told me before recording that I found really interesting is that interviewing.io's model is actually, once you feel adequate enough with your interviewing practice, their placement into employers is they're a recruiting agency of sorts.
Yeah.
And so I guess they might take some recruiter fee for placing people who are now well prepared for interviews and won't waste employers' time.
Yeah, yeah. It's really great. I think the way it works is once you've an interviewer has rated you high a couple times, I think you have to have like three interviews is like the minimum, and then you have to have some sort of rating of like they think you've done well enough. Mm-hmm. Then it moves on to this phase of matching. And I think so that they're pretty early, so I'm not sure, they may be changing a lot of
how their model works, sure
yeah, but that was kind of, that's how it worked when I did it, and it was super cool.
So something that you told me also just before we started recording was about how in your most recent job search you applied to Facebook, and at Facebook they have the author of Cracking the Code on their team as a contractor to help train candidates.
It wasn't that clear to me exactly what their relationship was, but they were and I think this was relatively new because it seemed like it had only been going on for so long, but basically every Wednesday, I think, they would host a session that you could either attend in person or on BlueJeans, like the video conference. And it was the author of Cracking the Code interview, Gail Ackman, giving like a slideshow presentation and like going through questions. And for people who are for interviewing, it was like super helpful because it's basically what, if you're an interviewer, what you wish every person you're going to interview had like, you know, spent the time doing. So I think that it seems like they were just like, well, we'll just.
That's crazy, man. Yeah. Why do you think they do that? Why do you think an employer is hiring a consultant to assist their candidates with their interview format?
Yeah, it seems like maybe they could just change the format to not need that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's just like, because that interview format is so common, like it seems like it is a pretty common format across the companies I interviewed.
Yeah, the big ones like Google, Facebook, and you're now at Stripe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll talk about that in a minute. But Stripe was very, very different experience. I imagine that they did it just because they wanted to have the candidate put their best foot forward. Because when I've done interviews in the past, there have been a couple times where I'm interviewing someone and it's clear that they just hadn't really gone through the format recently.
Yeah.
And it's like a muscle, you know. It's like if you haven't exercised it recently, it's not going to work out well the first time you go out and try to like do it in front of people.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And you're kind of out of practice.
Well, does Google offer anything like this for candidates?
They sent out like an informational document that pointed to some resources, but they didn't offer anything to the extent of, you know,
bringing on the
name in coding interview.
That's goofy. And it's crazy that this is like engineering specific. I think it says something about the job market in engineering that employers, albeit among the biggest employers, are hiring outside contractors to help their candidates train for their interviews. I mean, yeah, like you said, maybe the format should be changed. But any idea why Facebook might not be doing this for their marketing candidates that apply for jobs?
I imagine the interview format is maybe doesn't lend itself as much to the kind of practice that the technical format does. Because I think, honestly, I haven't gone through that a different. Most of the interviews I've had have been in a technical format, so I'm not exactly sure what would be beneficial, but I do know that for technical interviews, at least, there is just sort of this like base level of like practice or like familiarity with the format that is kind of almost like a leveling effect of, okay, now if once you've got that base level, then it's like, okay, how good are you past this base level? Whereas there could be something that's really good that just doesn't hasn't practiced enough or hasn't had the experience with the format, and you totally miss the signal on them, and it's kind of unfortunate.
Well, you chose to accept a role with Stripe, and you just mentioned how their interview process is different. So do you mind maybe without not disclosing the secret sauce, maybe that now that you work for them, you're interviewing candidates potentially, and so you know how reverse engineerable interviews are, but do you mind sharing just how they're different from Facebook and Google?
Yeah, it was actually really refreshing. And actually, it was funny. I had interviewed at another company that was mimicking Stripe's interview format. So I actually got the same format twice, which is very funny. But anyway, so the format there is, instead of, there's almost no whiteboarding. The only time I was on a whiteboard was for a system design. So like, and I think I could have done it without going to the whiteboard if I didn't want to, but I like drawing like little circles and arrows.
Who doesn't?
Like
a,
yeah. All right. But the rest of it, I brought my own laptop. Mm-hmm. And they had questions, coding questions in, you know, whatever language I chose Python for this. And it was, I was coding on my laptop and like sharing my screen with them. So I could use like an ID. I could Google things if I wanted to. So very much.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
You can use, when you're using your own laptop, you have a lot of familiarity with the tools that you use, like an IDE.
Yeah.
Or that's something I've noticed with interviewing candidates is it's helpful to lean towards inviting the candidate to bring their own laptop, because providing one as an interviewer is an alien environment. And it lends itself to disaster and a whole lot of wasting of time.
Yeah, definitely.
But this was over screen share? You were remotely?
Oh, yeah. So for the phone screen, it was over screen share. Mm-hmm. And then in person, I brought my laptop to the to the in-person interview.
Did they encourage you to, like I just described? Or?
Yeah, they said, please do bring your own laptop. If for whatever reason you don't have one, we can share one. Which is true. Like if... like for me, I actually, my work laptop was my
only laptop.
Yeah, it was my primary laptop. My personal laptop was kind of like a
oh man,
you very don't wanna, old kind of junky one.
You don't want to interview for a job using your current employer's hardware.
Yeah, exactly, definitely. that would be very bad. Which is funny though, because generally you set up your environment on your work laptop to be like great, and then maybe not so much on your personal laptop. So you do have to like remember to go set up your personal laptop in the same way.
But what were the questions like? You mentioned walking through, it sounds like programming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there were a couple different formats. One of them was like a bug bash. That was like the coolest one. So you would go through an actual open source project. And this is on like Stripe's blog and things. So it's
public information.
Yeah.
Sure.
So they would have a bug from an open source project in, whatever language you wanted. And you would go through and find, basically be like an issue that someone had submitted to the project. And you would have to go through and figure out what the issue was and try to solve it in this like hour long block, which was like very cool. Cause you had to like navigate through this code base and like, a lot of, if it's an open source project that has a lot of traction, it's a big code base and, trying to dig in, it does sort of mimic what you're doing in your day-to-day job. That was one format, which I think was the hardest one, because it's kind of, there's definitely like a set endpoint of like, did you solve the bug? I later learned that like, there's like a lot of interview questions, there's a lot of room to judge how progress along the way. But at the time it was like, I gotta fix this thing,
Closing a bug can be incredibly hard on an open source project. I mean, besides submitting a pull request to the project, trying to reproduce the bug.
Yeah.
If whoever submitted the bug didn't share information about how to reproduce the bug.
Mm-hmm.
Even getting your development environment set up for certain open source projects.
Yeah, to pull the product down. Yeah. there was, they had selected certain things, certain bugs that were amenable to this kind of setup.
Okay. So they had pre-screened what bug you might be working on.
Yeah. So it wasn't like, it wasn't as,
jank or
it would be
real
like,
world. Okay. So that was one type of interview, mm-hmm. was the fixing an open source or closing an open source issue.
Yeah. That was one. There was one where it was integrating with an existing system. So they had the system and they were basically like, we want you to add some functionality to it. So I'm trying to remember exactly, but that was like basically the format where you have some endpoint, I think, you basically have like an API endpoint, and you have to integrate some code to interact with that endpoint and do something useful.
Sure, sure.
Which is kind of similar, similar to real life coding.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to think. I think there's one other. Yeah, there's one that was more like one that was like purely system design. That was one where I was on the whiteboard, and then there was another one that was more. It was called like pair programming, and it was supposed to be like working together to solve this problem. It ended up that one looked a little bit more like the typical whiteboarding, but just instead on a laptop, because it's like it's pair programming, but like your partner in pairing knows all the answers, so like so it's more like at least that's how it felt in my particular case.
Oh,
I'm
for
not sure.
Sure
if that changed.
Oh yeah, yeah. So one thing I've been asking folks who come on as guests is about your current employer's tech stack. So programming languages, frameworks, whatever other technologies you guys are using. Because by and large, I mean, this is public information. If you look at people's jobs listings, they generally include what types of skills they're looking for. But I think this is an interesting topic for a lot of our audiences. What programming languages are used at Stripe? What database softwares are being used at Stripe? That sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. So we use a lot of Ruby, and I was coming from a Python background.
At Google or Judicata?
Judicata was a lot of Python. Google was mostly C++, actually, which like coming in was very intimidating. But it turns out like C++ at Google, especially, they've kind of taken off a lot of the sharp edges of C++, and it feels a lot like Java less scary language, because I feel like C++, you like have
memory
allocating
management.
Memory. Yeah, it's like it can get kind of crazy.
Sure.
But yeah, so
Ruby.
There's some Go. We do, it's like Ruby is like the main language we use, and then some Go. And so for like database technologies, we use a lot of Mongo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's kind of like our like main stack. There is some like Scala for data pipeline and analysis stuff.
I'm realizing just now that we didn't even really go over what type of role you hold at Stripe. So it's given that you're an engineer, but what is it? What team do you work on there, and what's your role there?
Sure. So I joined the my team is called a delivery, it's an infrastructure team, and so we handle the kind of we're like the interface between the rest of Stripe and our actual servers.
Okay.
So like our virtual or VMs basically. So we handle, instance management and like provisioning these machines, and then getting the code from people's laptops to the actual machines.
Sure. Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So ideally like they wouldn't have to know how the cloud management stuff works, and they won't have to go in like the AWS console and like type things in. They'll be able to use our tools and not have to think about that. So that's kind of like my team's role in there.
So what does the tool chain kind of look like? You guys probably use Git and have some type of continuous delivery, continuous integration pipeline. Do you mind? I don't know if this is public information, but do you mind sharing what softwares you guys use there, or services if they're third party?
I'll have to double check what all is
public. okay. But maybe even, are these all services, whether internal or external, that you interact with using Ruby for the orchestration, or is it entirely third-party service where you as a Stripe employee or the people who work with your team on delivering software go to a third party's website and orchestrate things from there?
Yeah, it's mostly managed in-house. So we do, we don't own our hardware, so we're using VMs. So we don't do any of that kind of super low level stuff.
You don't drive down to San Jose?
Yeah, right.
Got it. Okay.
We don't. So the rest of the stuff is mostly, like a lot of places will have like cloud hosted versions where instead of using it on their machines, they'll license you a version that I'll run on your VMs.
Of course, you guys are a payments handling company.
yeah.
Using third-party servers to manage payments data and credit card data is probably a non-starter. So you guys pay licensing fees to these services that are otherwise publicly known, exactly. but running them on your guys' virtual machines.
Yeah.
That's fair. Okay, got it. Sorry to tread into territory that I don't know whether it's public information or not, but I think it's
I'm sure most of it is. I just don't want to, you know, accidentally say.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So I think one other topic that would be great to hear about from somebody who's worked at Google, at a startup, and now at Stripe is how does that delivery process look different from Google to startup to Stripe? Like, even if we don't cover what technologies or services you guys are using at Stripe, maybe even how long did it take to deploy software at Google versus how long did it take to deploy software from making a change on your laptop to it appearing in front of customers' faces?
Yeah, definitely. So at Google, I was on Google Analytics, and it was a weekly release that we would do, and that was, you know, I'm sure it's a completely different process at this point, but it would take a week, and if something went wrong in that week, there was like, you know, you'd have to roll back, and then everyone would be mad at you. So I remember I think it was Tuesdays it would roll out, and we had I'm not sure what the name, I think it was like a technical program manager. It was this kind of these group of people that were managing the release process basically, and they knew everything that was going out and when things broke. And so if they I remember they like sat in this particular part of the office, and they would come out on like Tuesday around deploy time, and if they like came over to your laptop or like your desk, it probably meant you broke something.
There's gotta be a better way to handle this. Okay, so
so they were pretty urgently trying to figure out what the fix was. So they'd be like, okay, hey, like what is this a, you know, they'd be trying to figure it out.
Oh my god, dude.
But that was whenever you saw it coming out, you'd be like, oh darn. Better start looking at what I deployed this week and see you, because I mean hopefully you were already kind of pretty comfortable with what you were deploying, but if they were coming out, it definitely was like, uh oh. Did I flip the flag this week? Like, so there's a lot of flag based feature flags, which is a
where you can turn on a new feature just when you want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Google is really big on that. That where they'll have a bunch of feature flags, and then you don't actually have to rebuild the code. You can just turn it off, flip the flag again, and turn it back on. You don't have to like, you know, recompile anything.
Sure.
So it's easier to say, okay, this thing broke. Let's flip it back to what it was before.
So you're at Google 2 years, and then you joined a startup.
Yeah, very different deployment.
how did deployments work at Judicata?
We did continuous deployment. So you would, as soon as you pushed it and it merged.
Tests.
Yeah, you would merge it, and then as soon it would get deployed as soon as it passed. Like we would do our UI tests at the after we merged, and then assuming that all went, it would, you know, get pushed right out. So it was like, rather than thinking like, oh, I need to plan, you know, 2 weeks in advance in order to get something out the door, because you usually have like a week in QA and then a week in, you know, the final week before, like so this was like instant. So it's very different, because especially just having so many fewer people. I mean, Judicata was, I think, 12 people when I joined. And compared to Google, even just the back end team was, I think, over 100. Mm-hmm. And that was like, you know, there's like many different teams that are working on this like overall product. And then it's kind of like they are like boundaries into other products. And it's just like this massive organization. Just pushing out code was just like so much faster and like so many fewer processes, because like you didn't need as many processes to manage. You know, there wasn't as much, you know, risk of stepping on other people's toes.
Mm-hmm.
And then at Stripe, it's, you know, I've been joking that I did like a Goldilocks thing where I went, you know, huge company with Google, you know, a lot of engineers, down to like very small with Judicata and 12, and then Stripe, which is like, you know, sort of middle of the road, you know, hundreds, but not like, you know, thousands
of employees. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So at a hundreds of persons company, mm-hmm. how many employees work on delivery?
Oh, so my team is 10 right now, I think.
Okay.
It's funny because at Google, there was, you know, the continuous testing environment had, you know, a whole staffed team with, like, sub-teams, you know, like, this whole, you know, organization.
Well, for those who are interested, Google's testing blog is really interesting. There's a lot of really cool stuff that comes out of it. One of the interesting tools I saw recently, and this might not be so new, is doing a UI diff to recognize regressions in CSS. Like, you change something or break something about a button that people need, and acceptance test will detect that that button isn't there anymore, and maybe it's the save button for Google Docs. So that was an interesting innovation in testing, and it might have been an older practice that I just recently became aware of, but the Google testing blog is really interesting, given that they have a lot of employees that could probably have enough time to write blog posts for the rest of us.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's always interesting, like, going from Google to outside of Google, where it's hard. It wasn't always clear what was a thing that Google did, or, like, was there an open source, like, equivalent that somebody did outside of Google, or some, maybe something even Google open sourced, and it became public. But yeah,
are there any best practices that you don't mind sharing about Stripe's software development lifecycle that didn't exist at Judicata or Google?
I think that Stripe's sort of at the point where there are processes that were made when it was a smaller company, and it's growing rapidly. So we're kind of at the point now where reassessing a lot of these processes and saying which of these still make sense and which of these need to kind of be rethought from, like, perspective of, oh, now this is, like, a very different set of constraints that we have. So I think, I don't know if that's really, like, a best practice per se or something, but just, like,
reevaluating.
Yeah. Constantly reevaluating. And I heard this saying recently that was, looking for orange extension cords, which is this kind of phrase where if you first join a company and you go into their office space and you just saw, like, an orange extension cord running across the floor, like, to plug some light in, you'd be like, this is really weird. I'm tripping on this. Why is this here? Whereas everyone else at the office has already said, like, oh, I can just step over this. This is, like,
this is not a risk.
Yeah, this is normal. Yeah, exactly. Like, what are you talking about? I don't even see this anymore. So that kind of thing, where especially as coming to as a new person to a company, you can provide a lot of value of, like, wait, this should not be here. Like, we should fix this.
Oh, for sure.
So yeah, like, I would say, like, constantly reevaluating. But also, like, if you're earlier in the game, don't spend too much time over optimizing too, because I think it's very easy to say, you know, we need this process to be, you know, bulletproof. But really, you know, if you're smaller, like at Judicata, our testing was good, but it wasn't like we didn't devote, you know, an entire group of engineers to improving it, because it just wasn't necessary.
This is a topic that often comes up at startups, is how much, why write tests if no one's paying you yet? I mean, this probably is not the case at Stripe, but may have been the case at Judicata, is it's more important to get features in front of customers than it is to guarantee that your next push won't break them.
So, if nobody's on your site, then if it's broken, then that's not
bad. I don't know. Would you say that over your career so far that you've gotten better at testing or knowing what to test?
I think it's honestly been a lot of, I think testing is a really good cultural thing. It's sort of like if everyone on your team is writing really good tests, then you're going to also write good tests. Mm-hmm. So if you're at a culture that doesn't have good tests, then you kind of have to be the one to, like, hey, let's write some tests on this. I've gone back and forth with, like, you know, every now and then I'll say, like, oh, I'm going to do, like, test driven development or something like that, where it's like, you know, one of those things where it's just like, I really like typed languages and things, because they make you feel, you know, they're like a blanket. They're like, oh, you're okay. Yeah. This is going to work.
This won't break in production.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, there's this, like, appeal of test-driven development. I'm like, oh, I have tested everything. Like, I have full test coverage. This is all great. But I don't know. I think it's generally, it's kind of like you have to fit the tool to the problem. Sure. So I think generally writing tests, like especially if you're fixing a bug, writing something that's going to say like, oh, did I actually fix the bug is pretty important. But sometimes, you know, for certain, like if it's like a configuration change to, especially now that I'm doing more infrastructure work, some of this stuff is like a little bit tougher to test. And I think it's partially because like infrastructure work, like the tooling around it is evolving. And I think testing around that will be easier as time goes on, but it's more difficult to, like, you can just poke it and say, okay, it worked. You know, I changed the port and the port is open now, that works. But, you know, testing that is,
not worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. That too.
One of the things I'm curious about from the style of interview that you encountered at Stripe, where you work on an open source issue and try and submit a pull request, is whether you're expected to write a test to prove that you've fixed whatever bug it was.
You weren't actually submitting it to, like, your solution, you wouldn't submit to the project, because it was generally a bug that had already actually been fixed.
So they have a, or this has been presented to more than one candidate potentially.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. And it wasn't, yeah. And so, like, it was a problem that would have already been fixed in the library, like upstream, and been merged.
Okay.
So I don't think Stripe isn't like sitting on a bunch of bugs that like they know how to fix. That would be kind of like bad.
That'd be pretty douchey. Yeah.
But yeah, and I think there was something like, this bug has been fixed, but just don't look up the answer or like how they fixed it, because, you know, that's going to ruin the interview.
Sure.
But yeah, so you were expected to, I mean, you were, as part of it, you were kind of supposed to reproduce it. I can't remember if there were like steps involved in, or like, you know, you should probably do these in this order, but it was definitely, it was less of like, write a bunch of unit tests to show that you did it, but more of like, can you prove that you actually fixed it?
And be able to dig down and identify where the root cause of the problem is. And
yeah. Sure.
Okay. Dude, these kinds of insights into interview processes is super interesting to our audience, because a lot of people honestly don't go out into the job market that often and get the kind of sample size that you most recently got interviewing with Google, Facebook, Stripe, others. So this is priceless, honestly. I was going to ask you about what specifically might be different about working at a payments company. Mm-hmm. I totally blinked when I started asking you semi-proprietary stuff about delivery and what third-party services you guys use. But having worked at these three different companies, are there specific security oddities to being at Stripe, where you're handling customer credit cards and payments, that you didn't have process-wise at your other jobs?
Definitely. There's different concerns along different companies. So at Google, we were always concerned about PII. Personally identifiable information.
Sure.
Since we were tracking, we're on Google Analytics, we're tracking people's traffic across the web. If they put their social security number in like a tag, then, you know, we've got to like get rid of that or something. I think that was like, you know, things like that of that nature would be something to worry about. And also, we always had to make sure that we weren't like crossing streams of data, where like we had the Google data of like you signed into Google, and we had the analytics data, which was particular to a site. And we could never mix those, because that would be, that would like violate the anonymity of someone browsing the internet.
And the worry there from Google is the existential threat of the big fist of government coming down on Google.
I don't know exactly. I think
the regulator in this case that Google's worried about is the Federal Trade Commission, because I know the Federal Trade Commission enforces stuff like advertisers disclosing that their content is paid, which is a big deal for Google. And if you know the search engine ads, the Google AdWords ads and search results have to be distinct from organic results. And the reason that's the case is because U.S. regulators require it. Although through A/B testing, it's gradually started to look like AdWords results are almost identical to the naked eye, to organic ones.
Yeah, the color behind, but I remember there was a discussion when the color became it was like, it used to be very dark blue, I think, behind, or maybe even yellow, around all of the ads that would precede your results, and it has steadily gotten less distinguishable.
Oh, yeah. And in some cases, for some really high cost keywords, your entire above the fold search results are paid.
Yeah. Like if you search like credit card, it's like,
oh, yeah. But that type of regulation is different than, like advertising is differently regulated than PII of payment information, because
definitely.
There's a lot of opportunity for fraud, for stealing of direct money as opposed to indirect money. So what are the PII obligations that impact the engineering team at Stripe?
Yeah, so there's like this whole, so one of like the thing, the value that Stripe adds is that you can accept a credit card and Stripe will handle or make it a lot easier for you to be what's called PCI compliant.
Okay.
And that basically means that if you store like a raw credit card, like somebody gives you like a picture of like a credit card and it has like a credit card number on it, as soon as you have that on anything, any hardware that you own or manage, there's like a whole set of compliance requirements. And so what Stripe does is they let you not have to worry about that. By the credit card numbers never touch your servers, they go straight to Stripe.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that we have all those requirements and we have those requirements for a lot, you know, we have a lot of
customers.
A lot of customers, a lot of credit cards that we have to, you know, not leak, or, you know, like not, you know, obviously not leak, but like not, they all have to be, compliant with these pretty, specific requirements.
So when you started at Stripe, was there an onboarding process specifically for educating new employees, no matter what role you're coming on, about these requirements?
Yeah, it was definitely, it's pretty core to Stripe's story, I think, especially from the early days of why Stripe sort of was this innovation, is that a company could start accepting payments and not have to, you know, study deeply the PCI rules.
Oh, for sure.
So there's definitely a lot of, you know, the onboarding was around, you know, the story of Stripe and how, like, what this sort of PCI entailed and why it was nice to not have to deal with it, and then what that meant for Stripe, which generally, like, you can imagine if credit cards are just like flying around and like on laptops or whatever, that would be bad. So generally, like, there are tools in place to make it so I don't have to like worry every day, like, oh shoot, did I accidentally get a credit card? Like, is my laptop now have to be under, like, you know, strict compliance or these kind of different things? So there's generally tools around it, but there's a lot of onboarding describing like why this matters and why it why we have to be careful about things.
I'm sure this is public information if it has happened before, but have there been any incidents? I mean, you haven't been at Stripe such a long time, but has Stripe ever had to cope with a security problem or a legal problem of failing to meet PCI compliance? This is a topic I'm not very familiar with, so.
Not that I know. I honestly haven't. I'm not too, I mean, I don't work directly with like compliance or really even the PCI layer. So hopefully not. Not to my knowledge.
I was just fishing because I don't know that much about the topic, nor do I know what the adverse outcomes are of failing to handle a credit card. Like, is it the government that sues you? Does the fraudster steal all your money? Like, this is a topic I'm not super familiar with.
I think so PCI wouldn't is kind of independent concern of fraud, because fraud, they don't care, you know. I mean, hopefully if you're PCI compliant, that means it's less likely that fraud is going to occur because you have all these constraints that PCI puts in place.
Mm-hmm.
But they're kind of, you know, the fraudsters are going to try whatever they can.
We've covered a lot of ground. I want to kind of save some for the next time that I imagine us talking about it. This has been tremendously helpful advice, I think, for people who are considering jobs at any of the companies that you've worked at before, or are maybe at Google right now and are considering leaving to join a startup. or just preparing themselves for the job market and interviews and that sort of thing. So, dang, thanks. This has been awesome.
Thanks for having me. Yeah,
appreciate it.